Hello and welcome to episode 215 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston. The eagle-eared listener will have noticed that it is just he and me this evening. Sadly, here we are, January 2022, and for the first time, I think, we've had an interruption to our guest schedule due to the Rona. So, Nick Atkin, if you are listening, hope you get better soon. We'll get you scheduled into the show a little later in the year. But it means that it's just you and me this week. How are you, Chris? How has your week been?
Oh, I'm very well, really. Thank you very much for asking, as you do traditionally at this point of the show. I've been pretty good, really. It's been a busy week. A fair few things happening. I guess we all sort of head into the new year blinking. I think we talked about this with Zara last week, didn't we? Like, you know, is this really only a few days into the month? No, it definitely does feel like I've been back at work for quite a long time. But yeah, it's okay, you know. It's been uneventful in many ways. Went into Birmingham yesterday for a bit of a wander about. I've not been there since before Christmas, really. Just a, you know, a bit of a walk around the bookshops and went for a cup of coffee in a nice little place. And that was nice, you know. Nice to spend some time, you know, with the family, etc. So it's all been quite chilled, really. And then today is Blue Monday, of course, the made up kind of day for, I don't know, was it somebody trying to sell holidays or something, made this up?
Yeah, it was something ridiculous like that. Preposterous.
I know you shake your head and sort of disagree with it, but I think the reason it's stuck with people is actually that I think people do, you know, they get to this point in the month, especially those of us who look at their bank balance after Christmas and think, oh yeah, I got paid quite a long time ago and I've spent it all. And then the bills come in from Christmas and all of that sort of thing. So, you know, whilst I agree, I understand, it is just a confection, right? But it's something that has kind of latched on. I mean, you can confect anything. You know, we could call it WB40 Day, but it doesn't mean to say that people would continue to call it WB40 Day for many years, whereas this Blue Monday thing stuck, I think. So I think there is something in it, not something scientific in it or anything like that, but that our day, you know, makes you think, you know what, we need to sort of get through this, get to the end of the month and everything will be okay.
I think it's a very good example of a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think that there was nothing in it. It was marketing fluff that was, trying to get people to book holidays or some equally, you know, trivial thing. But it has stuck, and I think that's not a good thing, because it's actually, it's because people keep saying this is the most miserable day of the year, it will make people miserable. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So it's a bit like one of the things I'm banging on a lot about at the moment, which is if you think that working in a hybrid way is going to be not as good as working face-to-face in an office, it shall be so, because everybody's going into it with a negative attitude. So I think it's very dangerous. I saw that DCMS, the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, were tweeting today about it like it was some sort of statement of fact. But there's loads of things like this. It's like the 10,000 step rule.
Yeah, that's I thought you were thinking about the 10,000 hours thing.
Oh, 10,000 hours, that's made up as well. And the 2 litres of water a day, made up, and yet these things stick. It's just a shame that the things that...
But I think they stick. Some of those things stick because they just seem intrinsically right. And that's not to say that they are right or even helpful. But there's got to be something in them sort of psychologically that we latch onto, because people could have come up with anything, right? It's just one of those things that happens to have stuck. So whether you like it or not, it is Blue Monday today.
There was something I was thinking about a couple of days ago, which is the idea of the single source of the truth, which is something that, again, sounds like it's a really good idea. And if anybody has done anything to study the way in which information flows between people in organisations, you will know that it is impossible. It's a nonsense, because there are multiple versions of truth, because that's the way that information works. And
I don't know. I think HMRC might have a view on that.
I think HMRC are a very good example. I mean, there's nothing like tax to be able to show how there'd be multiple versions of the truth. But yeah, I think there's I don't know. It just concerns me that these things get taken as read. In much more exciting news, as a moment of statement of fact. I can tell you categorically, having watched an episode of the Hairy Bikers, the cookery show, a few days ago on the television, steaming potatoes before mashing them, it's life-changing. I did it for the first time today. It's so exciting. A much better quality of mashed potato.
You did what before mashing them?
You steam rather than boil potatoes so that they don't take in as much moisture. So when you mash them, they are fluffier, and then the only moisture you add is milk or oat fodder or whatever it is if you're vegan. And it just, it's revelatory. I mean, 2022 is going to be the year of culinary revelation. I've now taken to spatchcocking chickens because it halves the cooking time, therefore much greener. Not so good for the chicken, admittedly, but I don't spatchcock them until butchered. I've worked out how to make bread at last over many years, and it's all about leaving flour with some water in it to just bubble away for a bit. Amazing. And then, as I say, this revelation of steaming potatoes before, it's life-changing stuff.
Okay, well, I bow to your great knowledge there about steaming your spuds before the critical moment. I'll think about it, and we'll see where we go. I mean, I found that if you slightly break up a pot noodle before you put the water in, it doesn't take quite so long to go soft, and then you can eat it faster when you're drunk. I mean, if that's any help.
I tell you what, Jay Rayner should be watching his back, because if this is the level of this podcast going forward, then we're going to be entering into new realms around culinary technique, which is very exciting.
So tell us, Matt, what have you done this week?
What have I done, other than learning new things about how to use potatoes? I have been trying to be able to make sense of planning for the year ahead, and trying to be able to do that thing around how do you make sense of an 18-month horizon when you can only really plan in 3-month blocks. And so that kind of logistical challenge has been going through my head. See, the one other work thing that has been going around my head, and I wrote a wee bit about it at the end of last week, is thinking about, so principle, if you want to make services available, so again, all technical now, but if you want to make services available to a customer, then you, through a digital channel, then ideally what you want to make sure is that the way you provide that service is done in structured systems with repeatable process, because otherwise what you have is a website talking to a person who then has to scrabble around with box files and bits of sellotape to be able to work out what to do, and then they type back, which is certainly how the Dixons website worked for many years, apparently. Anyway, for an organisation to be able to be worthwhile to make a service run in structured systems, there must be a threshold at which point it is economic or it is not, or it is worthwhile or it is not. So if you only run a process once a year and it doesn't involve very many people and it's not very complicated, it's probably not worth putting all the effort into making that a structured process in a repeatable system that enables it to be able to be digitally accessible. You're going to have to treat it as an exception. And it's going to be different in different cases and it's going to be very contextual, but thinking about at what point does it make sense to systemize this process as a way of thinking about how you, where you put your focus. It's kind of Pareto, I guess, in a way, that kind of idea of, okay, what's the 20% of stuff that's making 80% of our effort? But just to avoid getting to a point where you try to be able to put everything into a system, you know, the classic ERP trap, and ending up as a result not doing anything particularly well and everybody continuing to work in spreadsheets outside. So this kind of idea of minimum viable volume of what, how much do you need to be doing something in your organisation before it becomes worthwhile actually making it something that is hard embedded into systems. So that's what I've been thinking about this week.
Well, that's very interesting. I was reading a website today, and I don't know where I got it from. It was open in my browser as if I'd got it from somewhere, and I was thinking, well, I thought it might have been the WB40 group, but it was about services. It was about how you kind of think of services and whether they're linear or circular, or, you know, and it was really interesting actually, and it was as it turned out, it was aligned with a question I'd been asked by a client, so it helped my thinking with that. So yeah, maybe that's someone we can come back to if we in a future show.
It's all down to the kind of the Six Sigma thing, the, you know, total quality management, all of that jazz is still as relevant in many ways today for traditional organizations before you can even begin to think about making services digitally enabled. But I guess it's, you know, not sexy enough to look at, so therefore people just assume. We all know about assuming. Anyway, this week, because Nick's not going to be with us, we're going to take a look at two sort of related topics that have been in the news increasingly a lot recently. The wonderful world of crypto and the wonderful world of end-to-end encryption. So let's crack on.
So we're going to kick off with a look at, I don't think we've talked about this specifically in the past, a look at the NFT, these tokens that you cannot funge. And they've been around for a little while, and there's been lots of hype and excitement and despair, depending on where you sit in these matters. But there's been a little bit of the interest has been raised a little bit recently with, there has been talk about this Dune book that was bought for $3 million and quite a lot of mickey taking of how they're going to make that public. And of course, there's been some talk about Beanie Babies, Matt, and you've been reading a book.
Yeah, so I mean, the hype around NFTs now is absolutely real. I know somebody who works for one of the big auction houses, and they're all in on this. Because auction houses are basically just barrow boys with ties on. But it's a remarkable thing. It's a complete example of a bubble. And yeah, I saw a tweet a few weeks ago that said about somebody was reading a book called The Great Beanie Baby Bubble. And I think I mentioned it briefly last week on the show. I've just finished it, and it's a really interesting history of what happened in the late 90s. So it's a guy called Ty Warner, who worked for a company called Daikin, I think it was, which was the US's biggest manufacturer of soft toys for a while. And they had licenses to various IP for producing kids' toys from films and whatever. And then he was still is a bit of a character, should we say, as in a bit of a sociopath, as far as I can work out. And he went off and set up his own company, and he started manufacturing and importing from the Far East soft toys, and then he developed some more. And he was very obsessed with the detail and the design of these things, and he cared a lot about the quality of the product, and probably more so than a lot of his competitors. And then in the mid-90s, he created a new line of toy called the Beanie Baby, which was a small soft toy stuffed with beans, understuffed. So the big thing about it was poseable. And a lot of effort into the design of it, really cutesy, big eyes and all this stuff. And they initially sold around Chicago, which is where the company was based. And with a number of factors that affected it, it became a massive speculative bubble. Now, these toys, they were very, very tied, the company, the individual, very, very, very rigorous in that they should sell for $4.99. They were designed to be a pocket money toy, and he tightly controlled the costs and the wholesale price and the retail price. And then he also didn't sell to big outlets. He didn't sell to the Toys R Us or the big department chains. He only sold through what in the book they describe as mom and pop stores. It was small. You know, there were some chain stores, but they were tiny chains. They weren't big places like Sears. And that meant that he was able to have probably more control over the distribution of them. But it also led to there being a level of scarcity around what was going on. And this is late 90s, so the emergence of the internet also had a factor to play here. Pre-social networks, but people blogging and people self-publishing books. And what happened initially in Chicago, where there was a group of people who started to collect these things. And then the other thing that started to drive scarcity in the market was that every so often Ty Warner would decide to withdraw certain models of these things, certain editions of them, from market. And sometimes because he wanted to change them to be able to redesign them a bit, make the eyes a bit bigger or a slightly different colour or whatever. Sometimes he wanted to be able to remove them. And these factors combined meant that by the late 90s, specific examples of these toys that had sold for a fiver, $5, were selling for $2,500, $3,000. That there was a deal done with McDonald's to be able to create smaller versions of Beanie Babies that were going to be distributed as part of the Happy Meal thing, you know, give kids toys as well as bad food. And the result of that was that people were going in and buying hundreds of dollars worth of McDonald's food to be able to get hold of these supposedly limited edition, but limited in the sense of being sold in Happy Meals limited, so not limited at all. There were millions of these things around, but for this few years, and Ty became the biggest toy company in the US, and then it disappeared because all of a sudden they started to play it. They started to try to do more about the retirements. At one point they said, that's it, we're not going to manufacture Beanie Babies at all anymore. And that was the point at which the market completely collapsed. And then you had people who, you know, there was entire secondary markets of people who were selling Perspex boxes to be able to pristine store your Beanie Baby. And there were people who were making money, good money, out of selling little protectors to stick over the tags that came on the new models to be able to make sure that the tags remained pristine. And this huge thing where there were magazines and books being published that were saying about how you could be able to do these things. By the end, the only people, before it collapsed, the only people who were buying these things were adults. The kids had completely lost interest. But it became this thing that you were mad if you weren't involved in until the day when the whole thing collapsed. And at that point, you know, things that a few days before had been worth hundreds of thousands of dollars were worth a few hundred, if that. And the book is a wonderful exploration of how this whole speculative bubble came about. Roll forward to today and the world of non-fungible tokens and this idea of, I don't know if you can call it art, it's just stuff. I mean, it feels like the perfect kind of metaverse thing, and it's basically non-existent things being bought for non-existent money that nobody properly understands. And there's this idea that there's scarcity because every single non-fungible token is unique, and yet there isn't any scarcity at all because it's just ridiculously simple to be able to create almost endless non-fungible tokens, and all they are is a cryptographic reference point to a place on the internet that you go to anyway. And the other thing at the moment, which is classic bubble behavior, is that we have, if you publicly say anything bad about NFTs, you will be jumped on. Friend of the show Amy Keane has been saying some stuff recently on LinkedIn, and it's amazing how quickly the tech bros jump in to say that no, it can't possibly be a speculative bubble, this is the future, as if it's not some massive, great pyramid scheme. So there's something quite interesting about the technology here in that, have we gone from a thing in cryptocurrency and distributed ledgers that was originally going to be able to save us from the terrible, terrible world of, you know, financial services, financial systems and banking, that has evolved into an even more complicated Ponzi scheme to be able to do mass transfer of wealth from a very large number of individuals who don't have any to a very small number of individuals who already have quite a lot. And I think the thing for out of that for me is there a risk out of all of this that it's going to completely devalue what might be some inherent valuable ideas around distributed ledgers and crypto? Because when this thing goes pop, which it will, because these things always go pop, are we going to find that actually it will completely destroy the credibility of this technology because of some people who spotted an opportunity to get really rich really quickly and then get really, really poor even quicker?
Well, first of all, I think we should make a note of this, Matt, because that means, you know, you just said that there might be some value in this whole cryptocurrency, you know,
distributed ledgers.
Distributed ledger thing, right?
There might be. So
that's an interesting concession. I think that you've got, you know, obviously you've got the bubble, right? You've got a bubble that's definitely there and being pumped in various ways by people who are doing it for their own reasons, right? One of the great things from a privacy point of view, or maybe a crime point of view, actually more privacy, really, but because eventually, you know, you can be tracked. The whole thing about cryptocurrency is that it's completely trackable. But nobody really knows who's paying for these things. So if I buy a NFT for $1,000, I can then sell it for $2,000 and nobody will know that the wallet that bought it was actually also mine. And then I could sell it for $5,000 and that's also my money. So nobody's actually buying or selling these things, but it gives the impression that the value of this type of thing is going up. So I've no doubt there's a whole bunch of that going on. But bubbles, yes, they do burst, like, you know, the famous tulip bubble and things like that. But sometimes they take longer to burst than others, depending on how much money there is to go into the system. So if you think about football right now, right, think about the wages of a Premier League footballer. I have no idea, right? It's hundreds of thousands a week, right? No doubt. I've no idea. Maybe
bigger numbers than you can even comprehend.
Yeah. It and the numbers are, you know, obscene is a word, preposterous is a word. And how can, you know, it can't keep going up, right? It cannot keep going up. And when it all comes crashing down, the same question might be asked, you know, is this, it, how will it affect, how will it affect football? Don't know. No idea. And I'm sure these things have happened in other sports. I'm sure they've happened in other areas. But the football bubble has been going for a long time, right? You know, it's been going ever since the Sky Sports got in on the, you know, the football rights. And somehow the money keeps coming in, right? And where will it end? I don't know. Obviously it will, but it could be. It's been going for 20 years probably, and it might go for another 20 or 10 or who knows, right? So these bubbles, whilst they are bubbles, don't necessarily always collapse imminently. But I would also say that and somebody wrote this, it wasn't my idea, but I recognised it, you know, very quickly. I thought, hey, that's a really good analogy. There was, I don't think it was you that did this, but it might have been. Somebody talked about the fact that 20 years or so ago, maybe 30 years ago, there were people who would quite happily sell you a bit of the moon. And you could write off to this company who would draw up a legal document and tell you that you've bought an acre or square meter or something on the moon, and it was legally yours. And it was, in as much as under whatever treaties there are around, you know, nobody can really own it, but there's a kind of, it's a claim state, so that at such point should anybody want to use that bit of the moon. It was that kind of thing. And then somebody said basically that they'd done this for a laugh, you know, just, you know, once upon a time to give somebody a present or whatever. And then, of course, recently they'd gone to check what was going on. The company that told them, of course, has gone bust, and all the records for that, you know, are null and void. And that's essentially it, right? It's, you're buying a placeholder on a digital, in a digital medium, which may or may not be there in future. It's like buying a car in Second Life or something, or The Sims, or I think Second Life is probably Second Life.
Oh, it's still going.
It's still going.
Yeah, there was some news about them this week, I think, actually.
And there's been a trade in real money, you know, real money value for stuff on Second Life for a while, but that went up because people were playing it, and it went down again. There's real money value on Animal Crossing, right? It's not very much, but you know, you can buy certain items if you want. You can go onto a market and trade real money for items on Animal Crossing. Wherever you can trade something and you can make something that somebody wants, there's going to be this kind of thing. And we've paid, you know, as human beings, we've paid silly money for all sorts of crap over the years, and this is just the latest version. So I don't see it as a, personally, I don't see it as something that's going to discredit cryptocurrency and distributed ledgers. And as much as the technology is what it is, cryptocurrency's got, it's, you know, it's doing well enough discrediting itself, generally speaking, and the people involved in it. You know, this crypto land thing, you see this island, they're allowed to buy plots for, you know, $1 million basically worth of Ethereum. And it's just very, very, I mean, clearly, it's just an enormous scam. And that's the top and the bottom of it, right? It just is. But there's plenty of people who, you know, it ticks their boxes, it floats their boat, and as you say, you know, they'll quite happily fight you if you tell them it's the case. Just as there's people who will tell you that, you know, Brexit still, you know, is a good thing, and there's people who tell you that vaccines are, you know, sent by Bill Gates, you know, and what are you going to do?
So it does raise an interesting point, and it's also related to this concept of the metaverse that's been banging around recently as well, with the idea that I don't have an inherent problem with the idea of buying something that doesn't physically exist. So we buy it. When you buy a piece of software, you are buying a set of rights to something that is fairly intangible. When it becomes a piece of cloud-based software, it becomes less so. When companies like Unilever spend billions on a brand is completely ethereal. It has no, You know, there's the products that are associated with it, but brand value is a totally abstract concept. And when you start to look at it through that lens, you, I think, start to realise that there are things that are acceptable for us to buy that are less physical in manifestation. And there are things that, you know, I was fascinated by the idea of people buying music. And when people buy CDs or vinyl, they're buying the physical thing. They're not buying anything other than a very limited set of performance rights of the content held within. And people never really understood that. And that's why some people were much easier to get to in a paid-for streaming model, because it wasn't really giving up much because of the control that the record companies and whatever had over the content that you thought you were buying. But maybe that's... There's this kind of idea that we are in a stage where we're having to start to accept new things that we will pay money for that don't exist in the physical world. You see it a lot in computer games, and actually the computer games world now has turned into, it's not the software that you're buying, it really is the content within the software in many games now that is where the value is for the production companies of these games. I think that that's a separate thing. Is buying an NFT as a thing which has value that might accumulate value over time a good or a bad idea? Well, it's just an idea like buying gold, to be honest. But that's a separate thing from this is going to make me rich, and it's going to make me rich now, and it's impossible for it to go any way other than up bubble thinking. And so it's separating those two things out. But I think it is going to be harder and harder for people of our generation, certainly, to be able to discern what is a thing that it is okay to buy that doesn't exist, and a thing that isn't okay to buy that doesn't exist. Because, you know, where does one draw the line? How do you make value decisions about, you know, how do I verify that this might have some... Because it's not the crypto chain that's associated with it that verifies whether it is something of value or not, even though that's kind of what's being told.
Well, maybe. I mean, no, you're right. I mean, the blockchain doesn't tell you what the value is. It tells you that it's there and who it's assigned to. And there was a guy on the Twitters the other week who was, oh my God, I've been hacked and I've lost my NFT, right? And there was a whole thing about this guy who, there was an exploit on the MetaMask, I think it was on the MetaMask wallet, which is like a browser-based wallet thing. And he had an NFT which was worth, I don't know, you know, $100,000 or something. And it was stolen, right? It was transferred away from him without his knowledge. And he was... And people were told, ha ha, you know, you shouldn't have used MetaMask or whatever. And he was on there saying, oh, you shouldn't be laughing. You know, this is my children's college fund and stuff that I put into this. And, you know, this is really important to me. And eventually there was something happened where he managed to get it back. And it was, I think it cost him some money, right? Or some Ethereum or whatever. So, but the whole point was that this is for people, you know, people are investing real money in this. You know, they're getting to the point where it's, you know, this is important stuff now, but they don't seem to have any understanding really of what they're buying or what the risks are and what the, you know, what the platform is. So of course this guy got this monkey thing back, right? And he's like, oh yeah, I'm happy now. And the question you've got to ask yourself is, well, where will it be tomorrow? You know, whoa. It's like having your car stolen and because you left it open and then putting it back on your drive and leaving the door open again with the keys in it. There's no guarantee it's going to be there in the morning. And this world is not, it's not ready for the normal person. Even a cryptocurrency, really. I mean, you can go to Coinbase or Gemini or something, and you can put your details in and you can buy and sell cryptocurrency. And they're pretty good, you know, they're rock solid, really, in as much as, you know, they do all, you know, your customer stuff. They have to know who's doing that. You know, if you put money in, you won't lose it. It's not going to go away. But that Coinbase style sort of retail cryptocurrency is at the tip of the iceberg of cryptocurrency more generally. And if you really want to make money and gamble on cryptocurrency, it's going to make you a few quid. You can't do it on Coinbase, because by the time a cryptocurrency gets on Coinbase, it's kind of been through its rapid growth phase, and it's there it is, you know. So this thing is massive. It's a massive phenomenon. It's going to be there for as long as the internet's there, because there's nothing to stop anybody creating another network and saying, right, I've created a new network and here's the token. And if I want to trade with my family or my diaspora from my country around the world, and they're all going to use this network. There's nothing you can do to stop me if we all decide that this is worth X, Y, and Z. So it's kind of, it's here to stay. The bubbles, of course, will come and go, but the technology kind of is here. Well, let's move on from the awful con that is NFTs to something that is definitely not an awful con. Repeat, not an awful con. Well, nobody is definitely going to get rich out of it. No, this is a not-for-profit venture that you may or may not have heard about, and this is our WB40 Leadership Retreat. And what we are going to do is we are going to decamp to a pleasant location for a number of our WB40 community. We're going to get together and we're going to have a bit of a leadership unconference where we can swap ideas and thoughts and stories. Generally, just, you know, decompress a bit and then figure out what it is that makes each other tick and makes each other good leaders. We are going to do this on the 21st and the 22nd of April. Matt, that appears to be our provisional dates that we're going to try and stick to, right?
Yes, and it's up in...
Yeah, nearby, yeah, not far from...
So it might be a bit... Yeah, a bit of walking involved as well. If you're interested to find out more, it's not going to be hugely expensive. So we're going to do it as an experiment to see if we can make it happen more than anything else. So it's kind of just be pretty much at the cost that we will be incurring in terms of accommodation, whatever. We found a venue which is all looks very pleasant. So if you want to find out, drop us a line on Twitter, or if you're in the WB40 Signal group, you can find out more about it there if you haven't picked up on it already. If you want to join the WB40 Signal group, you can do that as well by dropping us a line on Twitter and we can send you the information. But the first WB40 Leadership Retreat, 21st of April this spring. As the Prime Minister goes through his current machinations or death throes, who knew? If only he'd had everybody working from home, it would have all been fine. But there are two remarkable campaigns going at the moment. Operation Save Big Dog, Operation Red Meat. Now, it appears that these are basically things to be able to try to be able to keep the man in his tawdry existence, but and also to be able to save the Conservative Party from losing all of the seats that it picked up at the last general election in what would have been traditionally Labour seats. Now, within that Operation Red Meat thing, it appears, we are once more seeing an assault on the idea of end-to-end encryption and some really wacko ideas coming out for apparently Saatchi and Saatchi created media campaigns to say how terrible end-to-end encryption is. Chris, what do you understand of this madness?
Well, there's been a long-standing dislike of end-to-end encryption by governments, and I think governments of all stripe really won't like end-to-end encryption because they just don't like people doing things that they can't see. Governments do have a tendency to want to know what's going on. And of course, end-to-end encryption is a bit like the cryptocurrency scene, in as much as cryptocurrency is powered by encryption. It's unbreakable in any meaningful sense, and it is something that's actually fairly trivial to implement. And that's the thing with end-to-end encryption on things like WhatsApp and Signal and all of these different services. And as much as it is trivial to implement, it does stop people from intercepting the messages in transit. So governments don't like it. We go back to, I can remember, you know, we've talked about this probably at the time, Amber Rudd, the Home Secretary back in previous Conservative government, talking about the necessary hashtags because she didn't really understand the language. Because, they wanted people to hand over the encryption key so that they could understand, you know, they could see these messages. Now, this is something that's been, as I say, it's been going on for a while, but it's a bit of a political football. It's something that can be used as, won't people think of the children thing. You know, the reason we can't have this is not because we want to snoop on everything you're doing, people. It's not that we don't want you to have privacy. It's because, well, you know, we're worried about what's going to happen to children online. And this apparently is behind this PR stunt, isn't it? And it was something to do with the idea is there's a box, like a glass box, and it's got an adult and a child in it. And every now and again, the glass turns opaque, so you can't see what's going on inside, which is meant to make you worry about what the adult and the child are doing. And that's meant to show what end-to-end encryption is doing. Now, if you think that that's a just a moral thing to do, that's fine. But it's a leading people to the view that encryption is bad and it is used by bad people to do bad things. A bit like the whole cryptocurrency thing, right? The cryptocurrency is bad and it's used by bad people to do bad things. And no doubt it is used by bad people to do bad things. And no doubt end-to-end encryption is used by bad people to do bad things. But that doesn't necessarily mean it is inherently bad. And I think my view on this is that it's just like crypto. Like I said before, you can't stop this stuff because you could ban, you could outlaw WhatsApp. You could say you're not allowed to have WhatsApp legally. You know, there are governments in different parts of the world that will stop you doing it. Or they'll try. But you can't stop somebody writing their own mobile app that has end-to-end encryption and giving another version of the app to somebody else and them sending encrypted messages between each other. There's no practical way to stop that. And if they can do it between each other, they can do it between 3 people or 5 people and 10 people. So it's just the most ridiculous exercise. But it does, you know, especially when you portray it the way that the government seems to be intending to portray it, it inflames passions and gets people's backs up.
So it's something I was thinking of this afternoon, actually, about how technology, a technology in its own right, is amoral. It isn't good or bad. It's only the application of the technology that gives it a moral, ethical dimension. You can choose to be able to use it in a immoral way or a moral way. And the idea that somehow you can prohibit certain sorts of use of technology by banning the technology in entirety, I mean, this is just political campaigning, surely. Because it's just, I mean, you could, beyond the idea of whether it is right or wrong, of you know, the policy being right or wrong, which is obviously wrong, it is daft, but it's also just impossible to implement. The internet would stop working. I mean, the connection that we are using at this moment is using HTTPS. That's end-to-end encryption. Banning that. All the government business happens in WhatsApp, for goodness sake. Banning that.
Yeah, exactly. You can't do it. You can't sensibly do it. But it's not about really banning end-to-end encryption, nor in as much as it's not about, you know, trying to reduce the amount of sugar in food isn't about banning sugar, you know, from the universe. It's just about taking it out of a area and saying, you can't use a WhatsApp-style app to talk to your friends. That's essentially what it's about. So, no, of course, they can't ban the technology. It's too late. It's like, I think of it a bit like the Kalashnikov. You know, this guy Kalashnikov, once upon a time, sat down and he built a remarkable weapon, really. It's all around the world. You know, it's used by people around the world because it's so simple and it's so maintainable. It's a rough and ready thing, and you know, you wouldn't trust your life to the fact that, you know, you're going to hit something when you fire it. But it's a remarkable thing, and there are people who can make Kalashnikovs all over the world now. Did he? And it's been the most awful, you know, it's just a miserable thing, right? It's slaughtered, you know, thousands and thousands of untold people, this weapon. And the fact that it's so simple and reproducible means that people who don't want to have automatic weapons can have automatic weapons quite easily. But if he had never done that, do you know what? We'd still have made each other's lives miserable. It wouldn't have changed anything, really.
So if you take that metaphor, though, because encryption can be used for good things, it can be used for bad things.
Yeah, and Kalashnikov really can't be used for many good things.
It's, you know, you're not going to use it for being able to print. But if you think about how we deal with firearms in this country, we do regulate them. We regulate them very tightly. You have to be licensed to be able to use certain sorts. Some sorts are completely banned. There is still a subset of the society who would use something that is, even if it's banned, and therefore that's a criminal offence. Are there ways of being able to regulate? You know, what are the, because yes, it exists, but you also want to be able to control somehow in its use. So are there models that we've got for how you might go about this? Because to just say, whatever, should it be that use of encryption in certain circumstances should be seen as a multiplier as to you are doing bad things, and therefore because you've done bad things, we'd also take into account you were trying to hide it as well?
I think that's, you know, I think that might be a potential way to look at it, if it wasn't so trivial, you know what I mean. It was not so trivial to implement. It's You can be stopped if you've got blacked out windows in the front of your car, right? That's outlawed. You're not allowed to drive. You know, you can have blacked out windows in the back of your car, but not in the front, because the police want to see who's driving the car and all that kind of thing. That doesn't stop people doing it, but it does give the police the power to stop you and, tell you to get the windows sorted out. All you could do is say you're not allowed to use these things. The question is how do you police it? How do you enforce it? And what's the unintended consequence for saying, you're not allowed to use a messaging app on your phone? It's like saying you can't use one when you're driving, right? You can't text while you're driving. Well, this is, you can't text using these particular tools at all, right?
And I guess if you even began to, the history of prohibition tells us that if you try to ban something, what you will get, as we have with guns and as we have with narcotics, we would just have a massive black market in encryption tools, which would create an entirely new class of criminality that would... the demand would be driven elsewhere anyway, because prohibition just fundamentally doesn't work.
And especially in the software realm, right? Because it would be the act just remarkably trivial to... I mean, Signal, I think, is an open source project, right? So... all you'd need is the source code and a compiler, and away you go, right? There's not that much to it to set up to fork your own version of Signal. So the genie's out of the bottle, I'm afraid. And it's one of those things that it's wishful thinking that you can put it back in again without becoming some sort of authoritarian Chinese-style dictatorship over, and that runs people's lives in an extremely microscopic way.
And so we come to the end of another show. Chris, what have you got in the week ahead?
Well, this week I am going somewhere. I am going to That London, which is a bit of a bit exciting, really. I've not been on the train for a little while. I haven't been anywhere, really. So, I'm going to That London for a couple of meetings with different people and go into the office to show my face and let them know that I'm still around. So that's nice. And other than that... meetings got a new client to set up as well, so I'm going to do some onboarding. And yeah, it's going to be quite a good weekend this weekend. I don't think there's that much going on this weekend. It's a fairly quiet one. But that's because sitting there with my trouser pockets hanging out, waiting for the paycheck.
I'm appearing or being recorded to appear on another podcast tomorrow, which is very exciting. I know. It's a chap I've known for many years now called Pontus Norren, he was one of the founders of a company called CloudReach, who were one of the particularly Google-focused cloud consulting companies. It was set up in about 2009. I was one of their very first clients when I was working at Imagination. They went on to sell the company a few years back. He's now finished his earn out, whatever you call it, and has now set up a new company called Savvy, which is looking at being able to help match software vendors to potential customers. So I don't know a huge amount about it. I'm not sure I'll find out a huge amount more about it when they're interviewing me, but hopefully we're going to get Pontus on the show soon as well to find out some more, because that is an interesting world. And other than that, it's finishing up the budgets for the next financial year, and I think we have our quarterly risk panel, which is as thrilling as it sounds. So that's going to be my week ahead. And then a big crunch game for the Hornets at the weekend with Norwich City, which is pretty much, if we win it, we might stay up, and if we lose it, we probably go down, would be my view. So all that to look forward to. So hopefully we'll have a guest on the show next week. COVID, what's the word I'm looking for?
Notwithstanding.
Notwithstanding, thank you very much. So have a lovely week between now and then, and we will see you again. And don't forget, if you want to find out more about the Leadership Retreat, just drop us a line on the Twitters.
Thank you once again for listening to WB40. You can catch us on the usual places. You can catch us on the internet at wb40podcast.com, on Twitter at wb40podcast. You can catch us on all good podcasting platforms. Go out into the street, strip naked, write "Listen to WB40" onto your bare buttocks, and run down the road. Help to share the love. See you later.